One of the subjects which has attracted a great deal of attention in the media over the past number of months and even years is the area of child abuse. Child abuse can take a variety of different forms, but it certainly has been very much in the news. Certainly, we in the church would not want to be guilty of it, but at the same time, to say that just because we're here in the church it doesn't occur would be foolish, because it does, unfortunately, occur even among people in the Church of God. And that's a very serious problem. Now, we also realize, and we have mentioned to you before, even, for example, when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles, we tell you to be very careful about disciplining your children, because you may do something that is perfectly legitimate in God's sight. In fact, appropriate, and in many cases very much needed where your child is concerned. But in this world, when people see that, in some people's minds, the thought of ever spanking a child at any point, in any way, to any degree, is child abuse. Would you think it would be possible that you could be guilty of child abuse? Now, we certainly hope not. But we must recognize that all abuse is not necessarily physical abuse. That it's also possible for a child to be abused mentally, for that child to be abused by the way he or she is treated, by the attitude that's shown in a family. It's possible for a child to be abused by neglect, by simply failing to take care of that child's needs. All of us certainly recognize that children are, by their very nature, defenseless. You know, God speaks of those who are fatherless and widows in that category of those who are defenseless, who really have no one to care for them. And God places a very special responsibility upon all of us to watch for them, to protect them, and to make sure that they're not abused in any way. And he even brings out in the Bible how often they are abused by carnal men. We certainly don't want to be guilty of that, but you see, God places a great emphasis upon it. And he tells us that failure to provide for a child's needs is, in fact, a form of abuse. Neglecting that child is, in fact, a form of abuse, a very serious form. Now, we should recognize that. I hope in our cases, when we talk about the fact that a child can be abused by neglect, that in our case maybe abuse is a strong term. But it is a term that we ought to recognize and come to grips with and see if we're faithfully fulfilling our responsibility of meeting the needs of those children. Now, of course, I realize that some of us here don't have children directly in one sense, but certainly the principles apply to us. We should recognize that as far as God is concerned, the most important thing about that child is that child's mind. There is nothing more important about that child than his mind. If that mind is abused, it doesn't matter whether you feed and clothe and nurture the body properly or not. The mind is harmed, is scarred, is destroyed. Many, many of the problems that we encounter, even in the ministry today, deal with problems that people have encountered as children, with what really amounts to mental abuse as a child. And some of the scars and the memories that hang on are truly tragic. And you can say, well, you ought to just put that all behind you. And we can quote scriptures where Paul says, I forget those things that are behind, and I press toward the mark of the prize of the high calling of God. And that's true, and we should, but when you've got those scars, it's awfully hard to put them completely behind you. It's awfully hard to forget all those things. They're very painful. And even though you pray about it and you try to put it behind you, sometimes they keep rearing their ugly heads once again. So we must be very, very careful that we guard our children's minds. One of the phrases I remember Dr. Meredith used to use, and it was certainly a very important phrase, he said, we must be careful to guard the door of our minds, to protect the entry, to make sure what we allow to come through the door of our minds, what we allow to come in. And that same phrase applies very directly where our children are concerned. We must guard the door of that child's mind, because that is the one most important thing that will survive. If the mind is properly trained and developed and used as it should be, then even though physical problems can come along, God can still use that mind. But if the mind is corrupt, it doesn't matter what a great athlete we have. It doesn't matter how intelligent a child is. It doesn't matter how much of a great personality they have, or what a great dresser they are, or how well they sing, or anything else. If that mind is scarred and polluted, God can't use that kind of a mind. So we have to be very, very careful about that. Now, anytime we study the subject of dealing with children and child rearing, the book of Proverbs comes to mind over and over again. Virtually, not everything, but virtually everything I have tonight is going to come from the book of Proverbs, at least as far as the scriptural portion of it. I have a great many quotes I'm going to give you as we progress along here from another book and some other articles as well. But here in Proverbs 21, it tells us in verse 2, "Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord ponders the hearts." Now, we bring that out not in the sense that it relates so much to the child's mind being vitally important, but it is important for us to analyze ourselves as we begin this study. Are we right in our own eyes? Are we automatically saying, well, I know I'm doing what I should be. I'm doing all right in this way. I'm certainly not abusing my child. Well, it says God ponders the hearts. We gave you the statistic a while back, and I don't really have it with me, so I may be slightly off in my quote. But I remember giving you the statistic a while back where one university asked a group of men how much interaction they had with their preschool children in an average day. And the estimates ranged anywhere from 15 to 45 minutes. And they figured that's how much time they spent actually interacting with the child. And some, you know, most of them would be kind of ashamed. Well, you know, I guess I only spend about 15 or 20 minutes a day with the child. I really should do more. And then they've actually pinned microphones in the area where the child was and recorded in a day's time how much actual interaction there was with the father. And they found that the figure actually was 8 seconds a day. That was the average, 8 seconds a day. Now, that's a terrible figure. And yet, as far as actual interaction, it was just that small. Just a little kind of a hello, how are you kind of a thing. And then it's gone. And there really wasn't that much there. So we ought to look at ourselves and realize that probably, in some ways, we overestimate what we're doing. And in some ways, perhaps we even underestimate what we're doing. We need to honestly look at ourselves and not allow ourselves to be deceived by our own way of thinking. Not deceiving ourselves that we're doing all right, but realizing that God ponders the heart. God looks at the real truth just across the page in Proverbs 20 and verse 17. He says, "Bread of deceit is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth shall be filled with gravel." So it tells us there that we can deceive ourselves. Now, we can apply that to other types of deceit, certainly, but we can deceive ourselves. And we can make ourselves believe we're doing all right. We're fairly successful. We're accomplishing what we should. But he said, if you do, and you're deceiving yourself, then on down the road, it's going to be like having a mouthful of gravel. A very unpleasant and painful experience. So, we don't want to be guilty of deceiving ourselves, even though it may be more pleasant at the time. We want to honestly look at the situation and ask if we really are guarding the door of our children's mind. We have to recognize that there are many factors that influence a child's mind. Some of them are negative, some of them are positive. We have probably all heard the old argument, at least in various ways, of which has the greatest effect, heredity or environment. And to to a great extent, the only thing we can affect is the environment. So which has the greater effect doesn't really mean that much to us in some senses. Those of you who aren't married yet, who are young and are considering it, then you ought to consider heredity too. If you want an intelligent child, it would be good to marry someone who can speak in, you know, multi-syllables, at least occasionally. And don't be swayed by looks or muscles or whatever it may be, but you should consider some of those things as well. But for most of us, the children are already here. See? So you can't change the heredity then. I remember reading that Sam Levinson, one of his books, he talked about his father and how that the children, they had, I believe there were 12 in the family, but whatever it was anyway, 8, something along that line. Once you get above a certain number, I mean, what's it matter? So anyway, they had quite a number, and finally one of the boys had gone into training, pre-med training to become a doctor, and had learned about birth control and so on, and had gone to his father and explained that. His father listened intently and then he said, "I have one question. Is it retroactive?" And, of course, doesn't work that way. But the children are already here, so the heredity is taken care of. Environment, however, we can affect. And it is very important that we do affect the environment that those children are brought up in. In this world, there are many factors that man looks at and says, this shapes a child. This is what makes him this way or makes her that way. Again, just to refresh our memories, let's realize something that the world doesn't realize. And that is that what makes a human being different from an animal is that there is a spirit in man which empowers the brain and gives us the ability to think and reason, which we call mind. Animals are created with instinct and do the things that they do out of instinct. Human beings are not. And we must learn. We must be taught. We're given a mind which is empowered by the spirit in man. And we recognize that that spirit has the ability to be influenced by another spirit. Now, 1 Corinthians 2, let's just go back there briefly. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. This ought to be a chapter that every once in a while you just go back and reread it just to remind yourself of what it means, what it says. It's so important in an understanding of God's Spirit and the Spirit in man. But I just want to point out one section here that shows us two different spirits that can affect the Spirit in man. He says in verse 12, "Now we have received not the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God." So God's Spirit enables us to know, to understand those things given to us by God, spiritual knowledge. But that other Spirit then obviously doesn't give you that knowledge. What kind of knowledge does it give you? Well, let's just go back a page here, I believe, in Romans 16. He says in verse 19 of Romans 16, "For your obedience is come abroad unto all men. I am glad, therefore, on your behalf. But yet I would have you wise unto that which is good and simple concerning evil." God's Spirit gives us the ability to be wise concerning that which is good. The spirit of this world gives us the ability to be, and it's perhaps a perversion of the word, but it gives us the ability to be wise in the things that are evil. It gives us an ability to see and to understand those things that are evil in a way that you don't when you're trying to live God's way. So the mind becomes affected by one of those two spirits. As we have brought out before, Mr. Salyer's example that he used on the refreshing program again was a very good example. It's like a pie graph. We've all seen a pie graph where a certain segment of the pie is filled in by something. And in essence, when we're dealing with the human mind, with the mind of a small child or one of us as adults, that mind is filled No, it's always filled. Now, what is it that fills it? Well, with us as God's children, with the Spirit of God in us, there is a section of the pie that is filled with God's Spirit. Whatever isn't filled with God's Spirit is being affected by Satan's broadcasting and Satan's Spirit. But the more of God's Spirit we have, the less of Satan's influence can be there. Now, while in a sense the child does not have God's Spirit within them, they still have the ability to be influenced by God's Spirit. They still have an ability to understand and to grasp things that even other children their own age can't grasp when it comes to spiritual matters. And sometimes I know our young people are kind of amazed because they have been brought up in the church and they've always accepted these things. And then, you know, they talk with some of their friends and their friends can't see it at all, can't understand it at all. And they think, well, you know, what's wrong with them? It's simple. I mean, I've always known that. And they can't grasp it at all. I remember we were talking with the Dukes, Mr. and Mrs. Russell Duke, who were here with the young ambassadors a while back, and we were talking with them about their son, Chris. And Chris is, he must be about, I think Mr. Duke said he was 14 going on 23. And he was, they were talking with Chris and their daughter, I want to say Tracy, but I don't remember if that's it or not. Anyway, their daughter's a little bit younger. And Mrs. Duke was telling us they were talking, and Tracy was saying something about, you know, her dad had been teaching her how to swim. And she was starting to do a lot better and so on. And Mrs. Duke said she turned around to her son and said, well, Chris, who taught you to swim? And his response was, well, I've always known how. So that's kind of his approach to life right now. I've always known. And sometimes that can develop. You know, we can get that kind of an approach, kind of an attitude. Anyway, I don't know how I got off on that. But we have to recognize the influences that we can have in our mind, that God's Spirit can affect us. I know I was talking about how our children sometimes don't realize how much they actually understand that other children just can't. And that's because of the effect of God's Spirit upon them, even though it's not in them. It's in the home. And that puts them in a special category, and there's a special understanding that they have that others don't have because they've been exposed to the Spirit of God. So their minds can be influenced as well. Any mind has the ability to be influenced either by the spirit of this world, and we know who the God of this world is, or by the Spirit of God. Now, that's a unique thing of the human spirit. We're able to be affected in that way. We, of all people, recognize that this is Satan's world. In 1 John chapter 2, again, this is a section that ought to be burned into our minds, and we ought to be on our knees and asking God, help me to see this. Help me to understand it. Help me to see what it means in my life. He says in 1 John 2 and verse 15, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. Now we're told that this world is permeated with this way of thinking that Satan has, of the satisfying of the flesh, of the eyes, of the ego. It's all wrapped up in this world. That's what it offers. It's what Satan's world offers to us. And that is a very powerful pull. And we must recognize that that's what's pulling on all of us, but it's also pulling on our children. That influence of Satan's world is there. Now, man simply tries to document without realizing what he's doing. He tries to document the cumulative effect of Satan's broadcasting upon a human mind. So he says, when the child is 8 months old or 18 months old, let's say, he's going to have certain characteristics. When he's 2 years old and Satan's spirit has been bombarding that mind and it's receiving no instruction, no guidance, no help from God's Spirit, the influence of God's Spirit in that home, what's a child going to be like? Well, we have the terrible twos. The child's favorite word is no, which, of course, is probably the first word any child learns. No, no. This is constantly what we tell them. But at the same time, then they go on, well, at age 4, they'll be like this. At age 5, at age 12, at age 16, they have these characteristics. And all the man is really doing is documenting what happens when you have the cumulative effect of 16 years of Satan's broadcasting on a human mind. Then this is the attitude that's going to be there. But it's not supposed to be that way. That isn't the way God wants it to be. That's simply a statement that this is what happens when you don't give that mind any guidance. When, in effect, by neglect, you abuse that child's mind. Then this is what's produced. Now, we certainly don't want to be guilty of that. But we, of all people, have to recognize that this is Satan's world. And in Satan's world, he projects his moods, his attitudes, his way of thinking, his values, his mores, through that spiritual influence. Subtle, invisible, imperceptible by physical methods, but still that's the major impact upon children, upon all of us. But it's a major impact upon a child's mind. Now that comes out in various attitudes that are shown, in moods that a child can pick up. You all know, just as we experience as adults, we also experience in our children that there are times when your children get up one day and they are in a certain mood or attitude. And there's no particular reason for it. They just get up grouchy, or they get up whatever mood it may be. And that's not the way it should be. We should look around us and recognize Satan's influence in the world. We've talked a great deal about music and how Satan uses music to affect minds. That's what he's affecting, minds. That's what he's concerned about, affecting the mind. Why does Satan push illicit sex? Because it affects the mind. It changes the way an individual looks at the sacred relationship marriage is supposed to be. It distorts that individual's comprehension of what God intends a family to be. So Satan pushes that. As a child goes out of his home into the world, he is affected very greatly by his peers and the values that they have. But his peers, you know, when we're talking about a church child who's grown up in the home where there's God's Spirit and has been taught the right way and they're sent out into the world and they're suddenly exposed to a whole new group of peers, and in most cases, not a single one of those peers has ever had the influence of God's Spirit. The only influence they've had is Satan's Spirit. And the values that those children have are not God's values, but instead the values of Satan's world. And that peer pressure becomes a tremendous force in molding and shaping that child's mind, so that things which make absolutely no sense become very much accepted, because after all, that's what's done in the peer group. Now, we also have other influences on that child's mind. We hope positive influences as well. The home should be an influence on that child's mind. It should be a place where that child has security and safety and a sense of belonging to a family. God is a family, and he wants children to experience what it means to be in a family. Many of the time I talk to a person in God's church today who will say, I can't really seem to pray. I can't really seem to have the right relationship with God, because when I get on my knees and I call him Father, the image that comes back to mind is my father. And my relationship with my father was not anything that I would ever want anyone to have. And it really scars very deeply the ability to even have a proper relationship with God. So God intends the children to have the positive influence of a good home, a good, strong family, surroundings that are stable, that are solid, that are neat and clean and well kept, that are giving the proper effect upon that child. I want to move on here, but you might tie in Proverbs chapter 24, verse 30 through 34, where Solomon said, I came across the field of the sluggard, And I looked at the way it looked, how it was overgrown with vines and thorns and thistles, and I learned. I learned from that what this way of life produces. Well, God intends a home to be a neat and a clean and a stable place where a child learns values that are right. I won't take a survey of how many women got married and found that they still had to pick up after their husbands because their husbands had never learned at home how to pick up after themselves. Because after all, mom always did it. And that's a wrong value, but there are an awful lot of homes that are that way, and of course much worse than that. We also recognize the church has an impact upon a child's mind. The YES, the YOU, those are excellent programs if the parents are involved, but we must recognize even there the goal and purpose of the church is described in Malachi 4, verse 5 and 6, of turning the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers. Not turning the hearts of the children to the church. We don't want to turn them away, obviously, but that's not our primary goal, to win them to the church, but instead to focus them back to their parents. Now, we need to recognize the influences that are there. One of the most pervasive, and one that I want to spend a good bit of time on this evening, is an influence of television. Now, I'm going to give you a number of quotes, and you're going to just have to listen, as I have a bunch of them. But I want to give you a number of quotes from a book entitled The Plug-In Drug by a lady named Marie Wynne. Now, just prior to that, I want to go back to one more proverb, though. Proverbs 22. Well, I guess two of them here. Proverbs 22 and verse 24. Now, we may not have thought of this in the sense of television or entertainment of various sorts. We do need to be very concerned about the content of what our children are seeing. It says here in Proverbs 22, verse 24, "Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man you shall not go, lest you learn his ways and get a snare to your soul." In other words, it tells us that when you choose to associate and be around someone who has that kind of a value, the kind of a person who's got a short fuse, who blows up quickly, who reacts in that way, you're going to tend to be that way yourself, even though you may see it in them and think, that's not the way to be. Just associating with that kind of a person is going to tend to make you a more violent person. Now, today, we have the opportunity to bring violent people right into our homes via the television. And it has been documented over and over again, the effect that it has upon children. It has an effect on adults, too, but as far as children are concerned, especially, that it tends to make them more violent as well. In Proverbs 23, in verse 7, it says, "For as he thinks in his heart, so is he." So we must be very careful what we allow into our minds. We do need to be concerned about the content of what our children are seeing. But I also would like to impress upon you that, frankly, the very process of watching television, in a sense, no matter what you watch, does have an impact as well. And I think a lot of times that is ignored. That is not really recognized, that there is a serious impact that just the process of sitting in front of the screen and watching can have. First of all, well, I'll just start going through the quotes and giving you some of the comments as we go along. Families today are watching television and almost an hour a day longer than in 1977, just 9 years ago. The average is more than 7 hours a day for the average family. 7 hours a day. Now, going on here, I have to give me time to turn back and forth. Preschool children are the single largest television audience in America. Even the most conservative estimates indicate that preschool children in America are spending more than a third of their waking hours watching television. More than a third of all the hours that that child is awake. Children are known to spend 4,000 more hours watching television in the course of their school careers than they actually spend in the classroom. Now, we talk about the importance of an education, but 4,000 hours more than being in the classroom. Television viewing takes up more of the average child's waking time than any other single activity. Now, that's an incredible figure, but more than any other thing they do. That's more than playing. They're spending time watching the television. No other new development has ever affected the lives of the most vulnerable segment of the population, preschool children, as swiftly, pervasively, and directly as the coming of television to the American home. The daily routine of a three-year-old was transformed by the availability of a television set as a child-rearing aid. Suddenly, 2, 3, 4, even 6 or 7 hours of the child's day began to be spent in an activity that is neither sleep nor play, but falls somewhere in between, an activity characterized by a novel intake of visual and auditory materials accompanied by behaviors quite uncommon among young children, silence, inactivity, mental passivity. Now, that's not a normal way for a child to be. You know that children are not normally quiet and just sitting. That's not a normal state. And yet children spend hours and hours doing that. The television-watching child will have spent at least 5,000 hours and perhaps double that much watching images on a screen by the age of 6. Conversely, the non-television child will have had 5,000 or more hours to devote to other formative activities during early childhood. Now, let's see. I want to go on and explain some of the effects that all of this has. Again and again, parents describe, often with considerable anxiety, the trance-like nature of their children's television watching. The child's facial expression is transformed. The jaw is relaxed and hangs open slightly. The tongue rests on the front teeth, if there are any. The eyes have a glazed, vacuous look. Occasionally, they come out of the trance when a commercial comes on, when the program ends, when they must go to the bathroom. But the obvious snapping out effect, as the face resumes a normal expression and the body returns to its normal state of semi-perpetual motion, only deepens the impression that the mental state of young children watching television is trance-like. There is certainly little indication that they are active and alert mentally. Now you stop and think about your children when they sit in front of the TV. What do they look like? What's the expression on their face? Is it one of, you know, here's someone who's really excited and intense and paying attention and so on, or is it just this kind of a dull look, a dull trance-like look? They also have what is called, and again, it would be interesting to know what some of you have found as well, what they call a reentry syndrome. In other words, the way a child reacts after sitting in front of television for a while. As time after time, parents note that their children's behavior seems to deteriorate just after they finish watching television. There's kind of a re-entry into reality, and that their behavior tends to go downhill. Focus, so that the viewer's reference point shifts every few seconds. This technique literally programs a short attention span. I suggest that the hyperactive child is attempting to recapture the dynamic quality of the television screen by rapidly changing his perceptual orientation. In other words, he says that you can create a hyperactive child by letting them sit and watch TV because of the rapid change that takes place. You know, the television scene basically changes somehow every 3 seconds. That's essentially the attention span. You can sit there and count 1, 2, 3, and you'll see the camera, the picture change somehow. It's not always that way, but generally speaking, that's the way it is. Now, it goes on to talk about the effect that this has on children. And again, I think you have to consider your own children in this. They're comparing here television addiction with alcohol addiction. Just as alcoholics are only vaguely aware of their addiction, feeling they can control their drinking more than they really do, people similarly overestimate their control over television watching. Self-confessed television addicts often feel they ought to do other things, but the fact that they don't If they don't read, they don't plant their garden or sew or crochet or play games or have conversations, it means that those activities are no longer as desirable to them as television is. A further sign of addiction is that an exclusive craving, this is a quote defining addiction, an exclusive craving for something is accompanied by a loss of discrimination towards the object which satisfies the craving. In other words, the alcoholic is not interested in the taste of the liquor that's available. Likewise, the compulsive eater is not particular about what he eats when there's food around. For many viewers, the process of watching television is far more important than the actual contents of the program being watched. Do you ever find yourself sitting and watching a program and you think when it's over, that was dumb? Why did I sit through this whole thing? Well, in a sense, it could be a sign of a somewhat addictive behavior, that just the process of watching becomes more important than what you're watching. Okay, I'll go on a little further here. One man says, my 10-year-old is as hooked on TV as an alcoholic is hooked on drink. He tries to strike desperate bargains. If you let me watch just 10 more minutes, I won't watch it all tomorrow, he says. It's pathetic. It scares me. You find that with your children. You say, time to turn it off. Oh, just a few minutes more. Just anything. Keep going. Now, I think it's important for us to recognize, though. Let's see. Am I getting ahead here? Yes. It's important to recognize, in the long run, who it is that's really addicted to television. Because television is so wonderfully available as a child amuser and child defuser, capable of rendering a volatile 3-year-old harmless at the flick of a switch, parents grow to depend upon it in the course of their daily lives. And as they continue to utilize television day after day, its importance in their children's lives increases. From a simple source of entertainment provided by parents when they need a break from child care, television gradually changes into a powerful and disruptive presence in family life. It is, in fact, the parents for whom television is an irresistible narcotic, not through their own viewing, although frequently this too is the case, but through their children, fanned out in front of the receiver, strangely quiet. Surely there can be no more insidious a drug than one you must administer to others in order to achieve an effect for yourself. In other words, he says, parents become addicted because the child is so active and they're so busy and they're demanding attention, and you can set them in front of the TV and turn it on, and they get quiet. And then you can do whatever you want to do. And as it says there, in fact, the parents become addicted. I'll go on a little further here on that line. Television has brought the modern parent instant relief from the difficulties of child care by transforming a third or more of the preschool child's waking hours from unpredictable activity to dependable passivity. A natural I don't think that's the section I wanted here. No, okay. When television appeared, it was seized upon as a way out of the dilemma of whether you spend time with the child or you try to get the things done that you feel you need to do. A flick of the switch transformed the child completely, albeit temporarily, from an energetic, noisy, intrusive creature craving activity and experience and requiring constant supervision and attention into a docile, quiet, undemanding presence. And this marvelous transformation was achieved with the child's cooperation. The child wanted to watch television, loved to watch, couldn't seem to have enough of it. As parents grow to depend on television more and more in their daily lives with their children, they withdraw from an active role in their children's upbringing and gradually become less and less capable of coping with their strong but undisciplined offspring. When we consider that children spend 3 to 7 hours of each day of the most formative years of their lives watching television, it begins to appear that the nightmare of child neglect has not ended. Okay, let me go on here. Two more quotes on that line. The obvious explanation of why parents of young children turn to television is that it presents the easiest and most reliable relief from the increasing difficulties of child care. The strategies once used by parents to survive life with small children simply seem too much trouble to parents today. As parents depend more and more on television, until they find they cannot manage without it. Television slowly infiltrates family life. One day they make the disturbing discovery that they have lost control over their children's television viewing. I think we ought to all stop and consider that in our own homes and in the habits that we have, that even parents can become addicted to the effect that television can have. Now, what is it that children actually need? What kind of stimulation does a child need? Surely the fact that young children watch so much television reflects the needs of parents to find a convenient source of amusement for their children and a moment of quiet for themselves. When parents work to improve children's programming, it is their own need that underlies their actions. To assuage their anxieties about the possible effects of those hours of quiet, passive television watching on their children, it makes parents feel less guilty, perhaps, if those hours at least seem educational. The needs of young children are quite different. Developing children need opportunities to work out basic family relationships, thereby coming to understand themselves. The television experience only reduces these opportunities. Young children need to develop a capacity for self-direction in order to liberate themselves from dependency. The television experience helps to perpetuate dependency. I'm going to interject another article right here concerning, it's called Kids Can Learn to Beat Boredom. It's boring, goes the chorus of eight-year-olds. Nearly anything can be dismissed with those words, but it's usually something that refreshes the mind or strengthens the soul. Walks in the woods, church services, talking to great Aunt Clara. To the kids, it's a cliche, something to say when they can't think of anything else. To parents, it can be a punch in the chops. Gone, apparently, are the days when mother would hear the dirty word and be ready with an answer, "You don't have anything to do, the floor needs to be washed." Also gone, apparently, are the parents who can bring themselves to say, "I'm sorry if you're bored with church, my party, this walk, my aunt, but we're here because it's important to me, not for you to be entertained." Have you ever noticed that the more there is to do, the more likely kids are to be bored? Many parents say, if my child is bored, then I should do something. Buy a toy, arrange a class, have a party, something. When parents try to find something for the child to do, they really are teaching children how to be helpless when they're bored, and that someone else is responsible for taking care of their boredom. Well, that's one of the things you can do. Instead of the child learning how to handle free time, instead they learn how to be bored. And I think it's you can draw an awful lot of information from those who grew up as children, let's say went through their childhood years, before television became so well pervasive in our society. Because for many who are sitting in this audience, you've never known a world where television wasn't constantly there. You even know what it's like. And yet, you know, we should realize it wasn't a matter that for, you know, 1940-some years or 1950-some years, well, no, I'll go further than that, nearly 5,000 or 5,500 years, everybody was bored. You know, for all that time, they were bored, and they were sitting around saying, "Boy, I really wish we had a TV." You know, and only in this generation have people found things to keep their interest. You know, that's not true. Before television, people had productive family lives as well. And we need to consider that. Okay, I know a number of you are going to sleep, but I'm going to go on anyway, because I think the quotes are important. Going on here. Children need to acquire fundamental skills in communication to learn to read, write, and express themselves flexibly and clearly in order to function as social creatures. The television experience does not further verbal development because it does not require any verbal participation on the child's part, merely passive intake. Children need to discover their own strengths and weaknesses in order to find fulfillment as adults in both work and play. Watching television does not lead to such discoveries. Indeed, it only limits children's involvement in those real-life activities that might offer their abilities a genuine testing ground. Finally, the television experience must be considered in relation to children's need to develop family skills in order to become successful parents themselves someday. These skills are a product of their present participation in family life, of their everyday experiences as family members. There is every indication that television has a destructive effect upon family life, diminishing its richness and variety. Efforts to make television more attractive to parents and children by improving programming can only lead to the increased reliance of parents upon television as a babysitter and the increased bondage of children to their television sets. Now, let's go on a little further. The idea comes to some people's mind, well, yes, but I only let my children watch educational TV, like Sesame Street or things along that line. All right, we have produced a whole generation that has come along as a television generation. Essentially, that generation hit, let's say, their teenage years or their high school years along in about the mid-60s. Okay, what effect, you know, if television is such a tremendous educational tool, what effect has there been on education? And, you know, have we had to change things? Schools have not had to readjust their first grade curricula to accommodate a new breed of well-prepared Sesame Street-wise children with higher levels of language maturity. They watch all the Sesame Street they want, and they haven't had to change curriculum because of that. The child is no more ready than he was before. Maybe not as ready. It goes on to give some of the reasons why people may feel that things like Sesame Street and so on are just very appropriate. Parents are so impressed at any learning children achieve at an early age that they generalize from the learning of a few things from the program to a far greater learning gain. In other words, they assume they've learned much more. Parents are misled by the narrow gains in letter and number recognition that come from watching Sesame Street into assuming the children are making gains in more general cognitive areas. Parents are influenced by the testimony of their friends about what their children's gain about their children's gains from watching Sesame Street. So they keep saying, well, you know, my kids really learned a lot. Oh, yeah, well, mine did too. Yeah. And everybody kind of feeds on this and think, oh, yes, so this is really great for us. Let's see. While some children enter kindergarten and even nursery school recognizing letters as a result of the emphasis placed on such recognition by Sesame Street, there is also, if we are to believe experienced teachers, a decrease in imaginative play and an increase in aimless running around, non-involvement in play materials, low frustration tolerance, poor persistence, and confusion about reality and fantasy. See, that's part of what they can learn as well. If those thousands and thousands of hours young children spend viewing television did serve as a source of verbal stimulation and did help to develop the verbal centers of the brain, if all those fine adult words and phrases coming out of the television set did function as effectively as real-life talking and listening, then surely a generation capable of expressing itself elegantly and clearly would have emerged. This does not appear to be the case. Indeed, a carefully controlled study designed to explore the relationship between television viewing and the language spoken by preschool children discovered an inverse relationship between viewing time and performance on tests of language development. The children in the study who viewed more television at home demonstrated lower language abilities. Now, I don't want to get into too much technical part here about the various hemispheres of the brain and the effect that it has there. Children's viewing experiences influence their reading in critical ways, affecting how much they read, what they read, how they feel about reading, and since writing skills are closely related to reading experiences, what they write and how well they write. Those children who have difficulty with reading are even more likely to combat boredom by turning to television than successful readers. Television plays a profoundly negative role in such children's intellectual development, since it is only by reading a great deal that they can hope to overcome the problem. All right, let's see. Also goes on to talk about what is called a lazy reader. This is an intelligent child from a highly educated family who has somehow never made the transition from the acquisition of the reading skill to an ability to absorb what he reads. A lazy reader reads well, but not attentively. That is, not with the degree of involvement and concentration required for full comprehension. Concentration, after all, is a skill that requires practice to develop. The television child's opportunities to learn to focus attention sharply and sustain concentration are limited. Now, how many times have you found or said yourself that you can start to read maybe an article in the Plain Truth, and you have to go back and read the same paragraph 3 or 4 times because you've read it and you don't even remember what was there. Why not? Could it be that we have developed the tendency to not concentrate? And could it be that the habit of watching the tube, where you don't have to concentrate, you don't even have to focus your eyes. Now, if you've ever noticed that, the images are not really that sharp. And you really don't have to focus. You have kind of a dull focus. If you're familiar with cameras, it would be kind of a fixed lens. You know, there's no focusing to it. It's just kind of in general, it's basically in focus. And that affects your mind as well. Anyway, here's a person who can, but for some reason they just don't seem to retain the information. For as much television as our boys, this is a quote from a headmaster of a boys' school in New York, for as much television as our boys watch, I have found no substantial correlation between the amount of television watching and the circulation of books from the library. The important change is in the kinds of books the boys read. What is really a new trend, it seems to me, is the great interest children have in reading, the non-book kind of thing. The most conspicuous example of a non-book is the Guinness Book of Records. See, the non-book seems designed to accommodate a new reading style. It is not the kind of book with a sustained story or a carefully developed argument that is read from beginning to end, but instead a book to be scanned, read in fits and starts, skimmed. It requires little concentration, focused thinking, or inner visualization. Any of those things. Yeah, you can pick up Guinness Book of World Records. It doesn't matter where you open it up. You can read a little bit, sit it down, and there's nothing to it. You've gained some information, but that's all. And there's no concentration. There's no thought that goes with it. And again, a direct correlation between that and television watching as well. Okay, let me go on a little further here. Evidence of a negative relationship between television viewing and school achievement. That is, evidence that the more television children view, the lower their school achievement, has been accumulating for the last 2 decades. Now again, note, we're not talking about what they're watching. We're simply talking about the fact that they're watching, that they're spending all these hours. One particular skill measured by the National Assessment of Educational Progress that has showed a significant decline during the past 15 years, an advanced reading skill called inferential reasoning, has caused particular concern among parents and educators. Inferential reasoning is the ability, beyond the mere mechanics of reading, to draw conclusions, form judgments, and interpret and create new ideas out of what one reads. It is the crucial factor that underpins meaningful reading in literature, history, science, and other subjects. Without this complex ability, reading becomes a superficial exercise. So that they're losing the ability to take the information and use it. They have the ability to take it in, but not any ability to put it together with other information and use it. The majority of students tend to use only the simplest sentence structure and the most elementary vocabulary when they write. The essays of 13 to 17-year-olds are far more awkward, incoherent, and disorganized today than the writings of teenagers of previous decades. I know Mr. Salyer mentioned that in evaluating the biographies, the autobiographies that the students who are applying to Ambassador College have to write, he said it's pathetic at times. The ignorance that's there, an inability to write in a way that you can even make out what kind of an idea they're trying to get across, much less being able to communicate effectively using the language, proper punctuation and grammar and so on. There's a terrible lack there. Learning to write is the hardest, most important thing any child does. Learning to write is learning to think. And probably, learning to write was one of the things I hated in school, because it did take more work than anything else did. And yet it's a very important skill, and television seems to have a very negative effect on that. Well, let's look at a couple of other things as well. I mentioned part of this earlier. Some interviews with some teachers who have been involved in teaching for a long time. Children do not play the way they used to. Outdoors, they're still vigorous. They still climb and run and use bikes and wagons. It's inside play that has changed. If you don't get as much dramatic play as you used to. Children are more interested in sitting down with so-called educational materials at a very young age. They don't seem to have as much imagination, either in verbal expression or in the ways they play or in the things they make. There's greater passivity about their play. They'll get interested in something, but then if it means they have to do something themselves, they'll lose interest. There's been a movement from active, impulsive kids who were just very eager to get their hands on things to do to more cautious, passive kids with attitudes of wanting to be entertained or instructed. Another teacher says, now I get the feeling that children want me to do all the initiating. They'll go along with the activities I initiate, and when I don't initiate anything, they'll just wait patiently until I do. They've been entertained so much by sitting in front of the TV, and it doesn't require anything on their part, just sit there and let it do its thing, that they don't know how to take care of themselves. Passive amusements will drive out active amusements. Since passive amusements require less effort than active ones, human nature dictates that, all other things being equal, doing something easier is preferable to doing something harder. That's one of the appeals that TV has. Now, then they make just a comment here about video games, and I thought I would read that to you as well. The kind of play such machines provide, however, while allowing more leeway for mental activity, and even the discharge of fantasy, than simply watching a TV set, nevertheless falls short of many older and simpler forms of play. Among these are children's activities that lead to the enlargement of a broad repertory of skills, making model airplanes, for instance, or the development of interests that the child might carry into adulthood, hobbies, for instance, or forms of play that do not involve the need for such visual concentration that they allow for conversation, discussion, and acquisition of social skills, like playing cards or board games. So even the video games can have that kind of a negative effect. I think I'll skip over a lot of my quotes here, lest the snoring get too loud. But there are a couple of other things that I do want to bring in with this. I'd like to bring in the effect that the television has on family life. While it has indeed kept the members of the family from dispersing, it has not served to bring them together. By its domination of the time families spend together, it destroys the special quality that distinguishes one family from another, a quality that depends to a great extent on what a family does, what special rituals, games, recurrent jokes, familiar songs, and shared activities it accumulates. Like the sorcerer of old, the television set casts its magic spell, freezing speech and action, turning the living into silent statues so long as the enchantment lasts. The primary danger of the television screen lies not so much in the behavior it produces, although there's danger there, as in the behavior it prevents. The talks, the games, the family festivities and arguments through which much of the child's learning takes place and through which his character is formed. Turning on the television set can turn off the process that transforms children into people. Of course, families today still do special things together at times. Go camping in the summer, go to the zoo on a nice Sunday, take various trips and expeditions, but their ordinary daily life together is diminished. That sitting around at the dinner table, that spontaneous taking up of an activity, those little games invented by children on the spur of the moment when there's nothing else to do, the scribbling, the chatting, and even the quarreling, all the things that form the fabric of a family, that define a childhood. In reality, it is those very demands that young children make upon a family that lead to growth. It is the way parents accede to those demands that builds the relationships upon which the future of the family depends. If the family does not accumulate its backlog of shared experiences, shared everyday experiences that occur and recur and change and develop, then it is not likely to survive as anything other than a caretaking institution. Let's see, I'll skip a portion of this. What has happened to family rituals, those regular, dependable, recurrent happenings that gave members of a family a feeling of belonging to a home rather than living in it merely for the sake of convenience? those experiences that act as the adhesive of family unity far more than any material advantage. It is not only the activities that a family might engage in together that are diminished by the powerful presence of television in the home. The relationships of the family members to each other are also affected. In its effect on family relationships, in its facilitation of parental withdrawal from an active role in the socialization of their children, and its replacement of family rituals and special events, television has played an important role in the disintegration of the American family. Now, one more quote on the family that I want to give you here. For contemporary parents, love toward each other has increasingly come to mean successful sexual relations, as witnessed by the proliferation of sex manuals and sex therapists. The opportunities for manifesting other forms of love through mutual support, understanding, nurturing, even to use an unpopular word, serving each other, are less and less available as mothers and fathers seek their independent destinies outside the family. As for love of children, this love is increasingly expressed through supplying material comforts, amusements, and educational opportunities. Parents show their love for their children by sending them to good schools and camps, by providing them with good food and good doctors, by buying their toys, books, games, and a television set of their very own. Parents will even go further and express their love by attending PTA meetings to improve their children's schools, or by joining groups that are acting to improve the quality of their children's television programs. But this is love at a distance, and it is rarely understood by children. The more direct forms of parental love require time and patience, steady, dependable, ungrudgingly given time actually spent with children, reading to them, comforting them, playing, joking, and working with them. But even if parents were eager and willing to demonstrate that sort of direct love to their children today, the opportunities are diminished. What with school and Little League and piano lessons and, of course, the inevitable television programs, a day seems to offer just enough time for a goodnight kiss. There are many other things that I could cover from this, but I would really encourage you, frankly, to check into the book because I think you would find it very, very helpful. We need to recognize that influence, not just the content. We need to recognize that when a child is watching television, he's not doing something else. He's not learning the skills of how to deal with other people, unless you consider how the latest private detective bashes somebody up the side of the head as an effective skill for dealing with people. They're not learning the things they need to learn. They're not learning how to function as members of a society or of a family. All right, now we've got to move on because I have another hour and a half worth here. If we see those dangers, we recognize what does influence the mind. How can we guard their minds? How can we guard their minds? First of all, we must remove the destructive influences. Back in the book of Proverbs once again, Proverbs 25 and verse 4, take away the dross from the silver, and there shall come forth a vessel for the finer. Get rid of those things. Eliminate those things which keep us from reaching the level that we should have. Those wrong influences that pollute, that adulterate the character that should be there. In Proverbs 24 and verse 10, he says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. I tied that proverb in because we need to recognize that making that kind of a change, watching those influences and eliminating those wrong influences, is a monumental struggle, especially when a child is already a TV addict. And when you consider that in many homes, a child is still virtually in his little crib and he's put in front of the TV before he can even understand what the words are or anything else, and is just kind of fascinated by the pictures, that child is being taught to be an addict early on. And breaking that addiction is a very painful process. And that's not the only thing, obviously, that we're talking about. But we need to recognize the negative influences and get rid of them. And it is a difficult thing. But as it says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. I would also say this book, if you happen to read it, does give you some strategies which may help in the process of weaning the family away from that tube. frankly, that's one reason why we don't have a bigger attendance at Bible study, because there are people who are addicted to a tube, and it's more important to be there than to be here, though they, I'm sure, would never admit that. And that's, don't look at everybody who's not here. You know, go to Sabbath services, I know what's wrong with you. You know, something else entirely. But we do need to recognize the danger is there. All right. Now, if we're going to remove those, we must be constantly aware of what those children are doing. Who are their companions? What are they listening to? What are they watching? We have to be aware of those things. And far too many times we're not. We're really not aware of them. In Proverbs 4 and verse 26, he says, ponder the path of your feet and let all your ways be established. We are told to think about what you're doing. Don't just let things go on and on and on. I mean, I can look back in my background and say, well, you know, we had a pretty decent family, so why shouldn't we do it just like we did back home? How do we do it back home? We spent far too many hours sitting in front of the stupid TV. It was a big mistake to sit there and watch. I can tell you all about, you know, Sea Hunt and some of the old things that, you know, we talk about now, and the young people are like, what's that? Never heard of that. But anyway, we need to think about what we're doing and not just accept standards that are not right. In Proverbs 27, in verse 23, I don't think we apply this to a family very often, but it very definitely applies to the head of a family looking at his family. Proverbs 27, verse 23, be you diligent to know the state of your flocks and look well to your herds. You are, in essence, a shepherd of your family. And you have the responsibility to shepherd your family, to know what condition they're in. You know, a shepherd can't just, you know, look out at the sheep once a day, spend 8 seconds a day with them or whatever, and he goes out in the morning and he finds a sheep dead and says, well, I guess that one was sick. You know, that doesn't do a lot of good, does it? You've got to be constantly aware, and you have to be aware and involved where your children are concerned. In Proverbs 13 in verse 20, he that walks with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. All right, you need to be aware of the companions your children have. What kind of person are they associating with? Now, one of the things which I think are really, well, I'll get to that in a moment. You need to be aware of what their companionships are. If they're associating with those whose values are not right, they're going to gain those values. If they're associating with those whose values are proper, then great. They'll strengthen one another. But you need to be, as a parent, aware of what's going on. You can't sit back and just assume because this child is the child of another church member that all the right values are there. That's not true. We hope we're all striving in that direction, but that's not true. And yet I think many parents do that. They just kind of sit back and say, well, their parents are in the church, so the kid's probably okay. You kids go back in the back room and play. You do your thing. You go over there. Don't bother me. I'm watching the tube. You need to be aware of what they're listening to and what they're watching. You know, I'm amazed sometimes at how much our young people spend time going to the movies, and I wonder, what do you see? What is there to watch? Are you as a parent aware? Are you involved and aware of what's going on, what they're seeing? What are their values? We need to remove those destructive influences, even when it's painful. And I know you may be busy. There's a proverb that applies to that too. In Proverbs 19 and verse 20. Verse 2 of Proverbs 19. Also that the soul be without knowledge, it's not good. But second phrase is what I want to emphasize. He that hastes with his feet sins. Now, that's not saying, you know, he that dances fast is a sinner. You know, only slow dancing is acceptable. What it's telling us there, I mean, some of us would never have to worry because no matter how much we try, we can't haste with our feet. But what it's telling us is that you can be so wrapped up in going and doing and being involved in this and running over here and doing that, and if you allow everything to gobble up your time, then you're going to be guilty of sin. Sin's going to creep in and you're not even going to recognize it. It's going to become a part of your life before you realize it. Okay, now we need to eliminate those negative influences. And we also need to add in the positive influences. In Proverbs 22, I think there is one of the most misapplied scriptures. Proverbs 22 and verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. Often I have seen this scripture applied in a negative way. Now, maybe in a sense I'm stretching the point, but I remember when I first started attending the church, one of the first things that I saw was the spokesman club in that area had put together, had made a group of Proverbs 22:6 paddles. And these were about the size of a bat used in cricket. It was about this long and about this wide, and it was fairly thin, not more than about a half inch or whatever. And Proverbs 22:6 written across it, and spank your child. I looked at that thing and went, oh no, I'm glad I'm 17. You know, nobody's going to do that. Break the paddle. But, you know, you looked at that, and the connotation was Proverbs 22:6, beat the kid. And that's not what it's saying. There is a place for spanking, and it should be used, and God says it should be used. Maybe we ought to be using more of it at times. But Proverbs 22:6 is a positive statement. Train the child in the way he should go. It does not say beat the child out of what he shouldn't, the way he shouldn't go. It is train him in the way he should go. Inject the positive values. Expose him to the positive things. Don't just stand around all the time and say, no, you can't do that. You can sit around, you know, and anytime the child comes up, Dad, can I? No. Can I go to the movie? No. Everything there is evil and vile and terrible, and you couldn't possibly see anything that would be worth seeing. But I wanted to go see Bambi, you know. I mean, yes, there's violence in Bambi. You know, We've got to stop and consider some of these things and inject the right values. When it comes to we're concerned about music. Okay, music can have some very negative values, but look, can't we show them the right values? How are they ever going to learn the right values unless we show the right values and expose them to the right values? You know, we've got a wonderful opportunity that came up. I'm not going to tell you much about it. In fact, I'm not going to tell you anything about it. I'll go on. But, no, it doesn't affect most of you. It just affects a few of you. But anyway, there are some tremendous opportunities in the area here to expose people to some good values, to some things that are really good. And are we doing it? Or are we just sitting around and saying, no, you can't listen to that? Don't listen to Judas Priest and Dio and Motley Crue and all the strange ones like that. I ought to listen to something good like Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and, you know, the old Roy Acuff. Now, there's good stuff. You know, that's not the right value that we're trying to inject. If we want them to learn the right way, we've got to expose them to the right way. And what are they going, you know, you're going to take your 16-year-old to the Houston Symphony and sit them down, and they're going to listen to this marvelous music, and from then on, they're going to be converted to classical music, right? No, it doesn't work that way. It's not going to be a one-time thing. But you need to expose them to what's good, what's valuable, what's proper. And then they can begin to learn the right values and compare. You need to inject or work with them toward developing the right kind of companionships. Encourage them when they're around someone who does have the right values. But you know, one of the things which I have noticed a lot of times, and I've touched upon it already, parents tend to be uninvolved with the relationships their children are in. They tend to be uninvolved when their children are with their peers. The parents are uninvolved. And it really shouldn't be that way. You ought to be a part with their lives too. And you ought to be encouraging them to bring their friends over to your home. That's fine. But when they're there, you don't go somewhere else. You're involved with them, whether you're playing games or talking with them or whatever. I remember one of the best times I had back in high school before I ever knew the truth was I remember one evening after a basketball game, about four or five, I guess there were six of us, went over to one family's home and just had some pizza and sat around and talked with this one girl's parents. And it was just great. We really enjoyed it. We really appreciated the fact that we could spend some time with them. They weren't judging or criticizing. They weren't lecturing us on anything. But it was just a matter of normal conversation. And it was good. It was right. You have to give them alternatives to what Satan's world offers. You don't have to give them wrong standards, but you do have to give them alternatives. We ought to have, frankly, a lot more interest in some of the activities that we have that are alternatives to Satan's world. Activities like the summer educational program. You know, we had, I don't know, maybe six or seven applications this year, and a few that got to go, and I know all are not going to get to go every year. But, you know, that's a good activity. That's something that ought to be encouraged. We ought to have a lot of people applying for that. And those who don't, what about the YOU camp out that we have? Last year, I think we had one person who went from the East Church, and this year we had six, I think it was, who went from the East Church. Where are all the rest? Now, there's a tremendous opportunity to be with other young people in that way. The various other activities that we have, we need to encourage that. How do you encourage it? Okay, kid, I'll get you a ride. You go to that activity. That doesn't encourage much. You've got to be involved, too. You've got to help with alternatives. And don't just look to the church. You've got to provide those alternatives, too. You've got to be a family. And be actively involved in God's church and God's way. Well, I have some Proverbs I want to turn to quickly here, and let's just close with those. In Proverbs 23, verse 24. The father of the righteous shall greatly rejoice, and he that begets a wise child shall have joy of him. Your father and your mother shall be glad, and she that bare you shall rejoice. That's what we're striving for. That's what we want. That's what we're looking forward to. In Proverbs 28, and verse 9, he that turns away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer shall be abomination. No, we want to make excuses for ourselves and say, oh, well, yeah, I guess that's all well and good, but, you know, not for me. I couldn't do that in my family. We couldn't make that change. We're too tied in to the way that we do things now. We've got to make those changes. In Proverbs 26, and verse 16, the sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. Do you find that as we talk about some of these things even this evening, that you have all kinds of reasons why you can't do it quite that way, or why it won't work, or why you don't need to make those changes, or why it doesn't affect you that way? As he said, a sluggard can render seven reasons. Or no, that isn't quite what he said. He's wiser in his own conceit than seven men that do have a reason. So we ought to look at ourselves and see, are we really ready to make that change? Are we willing to? Because we can be guilty of child abuse in God's sight by neglecting the proper formation of that child's mind. If we fail to root out the negative influences, you know, we talked about these cards that some of the children were trading back and forth, these garbage pail kids. I can't, you know, you look at those things and those are terrible. And as I mentioned Sabbath, even though in this case the parents threw the cards away, as it should have been done, the cards, every one of them, came from others within the church whose children were trading them back and forth. And I would dare say parents couldn't have been aware. They just couldn't have been aware of what it was. Either that or on some other planet. Because that's just, as it's called, pure garbage. So we have to be aware of those things. We have to be making those changes. If we don't root out the negative and provide the positive, then we're guilty of child abuse in God's sight. And that's a whole lot more important than whether we're guilty of it in man's sight or not. In man's sight, probably turning off the tube and throwing away the garbage pail kids and taking your kid to a symphony would be child abuse. But in God's sight, it isn't. And that's what counts. And we have to make sure that we're guarding the door of their minds. Obviously, we have to be setting the example ourselves. As we're dealing with those children, let's make sure we're guarding the door of their minds and protecting them. All right, well, I'm sorry that I'm over time. I hadn't particularly planned that, but as I mentioned, the book, The Plug-In Drug, you might enjoy finding a copy of it, and I really appreciate the copy that was given to me. There's some fascinating things in it. All right, I think that should take care of it, so God willing, we shall see you on the Sabbath.